Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Electoral College. And Richard, we turn to this topic today not just because there's a presidential election coming up next year, but also because a number of the Democrats running in that election, most vividly and explicitly Elizabeth Warren, are saying that they think it's time to junk the Electoral College. Now, on one level, not hard to see why from a Democrat's perspective. In two of the last five presidential elections, you had the Republican nominee win despite losing the popular vote. But that is something of an anomaly as a historical matter. Before those two instances, you only had three times in American history that the winner of the popular vote didn't also win the Electoral College. So before we even dive into the critiques here, let's just start with the history. Why did the founders set up the system this way? What did they think they were accomplishing?
All right. Well, the original Constitution, of course, was not something that believed remotely in popular democracy, and all of the founders would have blanched visibly at the thought that a simple majority vote of anything at any time should be dispositive of what went on. They were very cognizant of the constant tension between liberty and property. They knew that there were many people inside the system who had one vote but large estates. They knew there were many other people who had one vote but were extensive debtors, and what they were worried about was essentially if you have a simple majority, the debtors or the small people would essentially vote to expropriate the property of somebody else. And if you started to look at Madison talking about this, debtor relief was to him the real sign of a breakdown of a degenerate type system. So the Republican system is not a popular majority system. It's a system that has all sorts of chutes and ladders, blocks and gates in there, and some of them are perfectly evident. The Senate is supposed to be the elite body based on the Roman Senate. It has long terms and great statesmen. It was at the particular time not chosen by popular election, but was chosen by the legislatures of each state to give them basically a stronghold over the Congress. The House of Representatives was for short terms, that was picked by popular vote, but it wasn't a universal franchise either. What they did is they said, you will, in your particular state, use whatever system of electorate you have to pick the most numerous body. So the most liberal rules that you have on voting are the ones that you apply here. There was absolutely no requirement that the rules for voting in Maryland be the same as in Virginia. Each of these states essentially could pick its own formula so long as they made the most populous house of their own situation, the House of Burgesses, the Assembly or whatever, take it. So this system is essentially designed to make sure that you don't get popular democracies. Now, when it comes to the election of the president, what this does is it tries to carry forward the Connecticut Compromise, which essentially says we've got two houses, one which is based on population and one which is based essentially two votes for each state, and the two senators of each state are essentially indefeasible. They cannot be amended out of existence. And then you sum the two of them together to determine the number of electors. The key point here is they were thinking about a college. And these characters actually had the harebrained scheme that what would happen is that the electors would come together in the ordinary course of business and then debate amongst themselves, much as the College of Cardinals debates with its various members, to determine whom they would like to select as the President of the United States. The point of this system was to create yet another layer between the popular government and the popular sentiment on the one hand and the selection of the president. Now, this became, I think, very quickly unworkable, and people realized that if you wanted to vote for an electorate, you don't want to have the situation where everything could become unhinged. And so the new strategy became that the Electoral College was somebody where all the members of it were pledged in advance to pick a particular candidate. So the system that was hit upon was you put forward a slate of electors. If you're one person, I put forward a slate of electors. If I'm another person, whoever gets the most popular vote starts to win. And what happens is the way the constitutional provision reads, what it essentially says is that each state shall appoint in such matters the legislature must direct a number of electors. So the legislature appoints the method for choosing them, and then it sort of drops out of the process, and they have to do this. The pledge of electors seems to work pretty well. Now, the next question you ask is, well, why is it that we somehow really get majority-minority votes on this thing? Generally speaking, if you're going to win the Electoral College, you're going to win the popular vote as well. In recent years, it has been somewhat to the contrary, but it's much more complicated than you might think, based on the stuff. What happens is Donald Trump in 2016, he knew what the rules of the game was. He tried to win the Electoral College. He was willing to get one vote in Colorado or one vote in Michigan or one vote in any of the swing states, even if he gave up 20 votes in California. And so if you start the campaign in California, as Mrs. Clinton did, this was just a dumb maneuver, because if you know you already have a safe surplus, each additional vote gets you nothing, whereas if you could have managed to cobble together about 100,000 votes in three or four key Midwestern states, you'd have won the election. So if you lose the Electoral College, you're playing under different rules. It doesn't tell you what would happen if you had the other kind of election. Why do the Democrats want this? Why do the Democrats want to pack the Supreme Court? Their view is that they can unlock the huge majorities that they have in New York and California and essentially dictate the way in which the nation would run. The original framers had a very grim view of that. They thought essentially that diversity mattered in terms of geographical location, which is why they entrenched the senators and why it is they wanted to get some kind of dispersion and influence. They wanted to have a system, I think it's fairly fair to say, in which each section of the country would have some degree of representation. So historically, this is a very different phenomenon than the one that we have today.
Now, of course, if we take them at their word, it's not easy to get rid of the Electoral College. It's a constitutional provision, and so it would require a constitutional amendment, which raises this question, Richard. We are living through one of the most dormant windows in American history when it comes to constitutional amendments. We haven't had an original one in almost 50 years since they set the voting age at 18 in 1971. In the early 90s, you did have the passage of the 27th Amendment on legislative pay, but that had actually been introduced way back with the Bill of Rights and was just awaiting ratification. So given the high threshold to pass one and the polarization between the parties and the states, is it just pure fantasy when a politician in this day and age proposes something that requires a constitutional amendment? Should we just regard the amendment process as essentially dead?
I think it's really a rather complicated question. You can get a huge outswell which might change things. I think what happens is here you have to regard it as dead, because anybody who's from any small state, defined roughly speaking as a state with 15 or fewer electoral votes, know that they will simply disappear into the mists of history if this proposal is put together, because the popular votes are in the major population centers in New York and California, Chicago, perhaps a couple of other big cities, and that's where all the action will start to be. They will not be a presidential candidate within 300 miles of the Mississippi border if this thing is done, because you're not going to win this election in Jackson or Toluca. It's just not going to happen. So I think what happens is that the small states will be resolute on this party and will try to get rid of it, because they're saying, as part of the original plan of the union, we're small guys, we have to have certain kinds of protections, otherwise we'll be overwhelmed by the larger people, and this is not a majority rule situation. We're trying to put together a constitution in which every state that joins the union feels that it is not going to be taken advantage of once it gets there. If you think of this as a partnership amongst the states, and as the minimum condition of a partnership is that each state gets a set of benefits back from the central government when they agree to surrender part of their sovereignty, that's a very different model than popular majority. And these small states are going to cling to those particular guarantees. So I agree with you. This one is not going to pass. The question is whether the Democrats can concoct some circumvention scheme so they don't have to worry about the actual brutal task of trying to enact a new amendment.
Right. And there is an attempt to do an end run around the Electoral College without amending the Constitution. A number of states have passed legislation that commits them to cast their electoral votes for the winner of the national popular vote, regardless of the actual outcome in their state. Colorado just recently signed on to this. 11 other states and D.C. are already a part of it. Now, the states aren't bound to vote this way until they actually get enough other states signed on to decide an election, and they're still a ways off from that. But Richard, do the legal analysis for us here. Is this a clever workaround, or does this run afoul of the Constitution?
I think this is just blatantly unconstitutional and completely cynical. What happens is the power that the legislature has is to appoint the electors. And what you do is you appoint one of two slates. If they could get a slate that they wish to appoint, which says that we will follow this, then that slate would be fine. But we've always had competitive slates. That is, the way in which we run the Electoral College is we have a competition to see who gets it. And what happens is this particular statute or proposal is to say, I don't care which way that particular competition goes. We, the legislature, will determine to follow the preferences of people in other states, when in fact, of course, the whole Electoral College system is designed to make sure that each state could protect its own in a larger political arrangement, as I mentioned earlier on. So I don't think that this thing is remotely constitutional, even if it turned out that 100 states in the – sorry, if 50 states in the Union and the District of Columbia decided to go along with this idea. If you're talking about a structural protection in the Constitution, you have to have a constitutional amendment in order to overturn it. So I'm sure this thing would be litigated one way or another, but my guess is that the Supreme Court, particularly this Supreme Court, would say that you cannot do an end run of this magnitude around a basic provision by telling your electors that they become completely irrelevant and that the national popular vote dictates what we do rather than the preferences expressed by the citizens of the state. I think it's also worth mentioning that two states, Maine and Nebraska, I believe, each do the electoral calculation by giving two votes to the statewide situation, and then each congressional district runs a majority. And that's actually a kind of an interesting sort of provision, because what it does is it would take California, instead of it being 55-0, it would probably make it 51-4. And if you looked at Texas, instead of it being whatever it is, 37-0, it would probably be 29-8 or something like that, depending upon the mix. I don't think there's any constitutional objection to that particular provision, because each elector is bound to the people who have selected him, unlike the situation when the popular vote will govern everything that takes place.
Well, let me ask you about the structural conceit sort of undergirding that, because you see this with those systems they have in Maine and Nebraska, and you actually see it with this interstate compact idea too. This is a reminder of something that I think your average voter may not know, which is that we really don't have federal elections in the United States. We have state elections in which you can vote for federal candidates. So there are all these differences in who gets on the ballot where, in how and when voting is conducted, obviously in the tally of the electoral votes. Is there any virtue, Richard, to having a system that fragmented for something so basic as voting?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question as to whether or not you want to tie the presidential election to all the local elections that go on at any given time. One of the things that you have to worry about in all of these cases is if you have an issue which is likely to galvanize the voters of one party as opposed to the other, and you put the presidential value on, there's going to be some kind of a backflow. And so, for example, if you had something like Prop 8 on the ballot in California at that time and then have a presidential election, it's quite clear that the turnout is going to be much higher given that than it would be without it. It's not at all clear whether or not the percentage red, the percentage blue is going to change. But you can think of all sorts of other situations where it turns out that who else is on the ballot wouldn't matter. So, for example, if you're running for president as a Democrat and you have a very popular Democrat running for senator or for governor, that's obviously going to start to skew the way in which this works. The genius of the Electoral College is that what happens is it partitions 50 states, so it may well be that one of these dramatic considerations takes place in one state, but the other states are going to have completely different situations that are going to influence it there, and they will tend to cancel each other out. So if you want to run this thing as a popular vote, my view is you essentially have to change the entire structure of elections, have a president running in a presidential ballot with nothing else on the ticket any which way, anywhere, and then what you try to do is to figure out how you did it. The problem of doing this logistically as a separate election is, of course, formidable. The day that is chosen is set by the Constitution. You would have to amend that. And one of the things that I recall when Florida had its particular problems in 2000, I remember mentioning at the time, I believe Nancy Pelosi mentioned it as well, so great minds, quote unquote, think alike, which is, could you imagine running a national recount in a close election where the difference between the two parties is 1%? It would be a complete nightmare, because what happens under these circumstances, you don't commit vote fraud in New York if you're a Democrat when you know you have 58% of the vote. You don't commit vote fraud in New York if you're a Republican knowing that you can only have 42. But if this is a national election and it turns out the Democrats control most of the key levers, you have an enormous temptation to commit fraud to offset the vote fraud, which you are sure is going to take place in Nebraska or California or Texas or somewhere else. So I think, in effect, that if you want to run a system like this, and I certainly do not, you're going to have to completely change the way in which you monitor and organize these elections. Right now, we also have a tendency to motor voting. You could register on the last day, all these other kinds of things. This is absolutely disastrous in a presidential kind of an election. I could recall that in the New Hampshire election, many people were entitled to vote on the strength of their Massachusetts licenses, with a so-called promise that they were going to move to New Hampshire after the election was done, and that was enough to switch the outcome of the particular election. Things like that are going to happen in unimaginable ways. The entire electoral process in the United States is so incredibly complicated, so ornate. It is not perfect, but it is not disastrous. You try to change one part of this system without understanding how all the interlocking pieces fit together, you could get yourself into a major constitutional crisis.
The last question that I'll ask you, Richard, as this debate shows, America has clearly developed a political culture over the years that is much more explicitly democratic, little d democratic, than what the founders had in mind. I mean, when you look at the original design of the Electoral College or the fact that U.S. senators were chosen by state legislatures originally rather than the voters, the founders saw democracy as only one part of the equation, and they wanted a lot of guardrails. That is clearly not where we are today as a polity. Have we lost something important in that transition, or is this just kind of a healthy, organic process of political change?
Well, I don't think it's particularly healthy, because I think it's been completely thoughtless. And the other problem, of course, that we have is not only have we lost the guardrails with respect to election, but the original plan was to have a relatively small federal government with enumerated powers, because it was thought that the states were the dominant players under this particular kind of system, and that they were given the right to constrain the way in which the federal government ought to operate. We now have huge federal powers, and if we have unquestioned federal dominance, what's going to happen to individual states when this thing starts to play out in one of these elections? Nobody can really do. And one of the things you're worried about is, well, what's going to be the distribution between federal and state constitutional issues or powers? There's no question that in 1937 there was a huge expansion of the federal government, but it also remains the case today that many functions like zoning and so forth remain almost exclusively local, notwithstanding the federal power to regulate them if they so choose. You start to change the way in which the president is going to be elected or the way in which Congress members are going to be elected, it may well completely change that particular picture as well. And I have always been a defender of the pre-1937 election rules, and I've always been a defender of property rights. And the old simple hypothetical, if you have 51% of the votes and no constitutional constraints, can you simply vote to confiscate the wealth of those people who are less numerous and more rich and more wealthy than you are? This is no longer an abstract judgment at this particular point, because Ms. Warren has put forward the wealth tax. And this is just a tax on total assets, whether you've made or lost money in the particular year. She sets it at 2-3%. But if you look at the supporting statements, you could turn it around next year and set it at 20-30%, given if it turns out it's constitutional. And it's exactly that kind of nightmare which really goes in there, because if you start engaging in mass confiscation, it's a very short time before you start to look like Cuba, you start to look like Venezuela. People will have a huge tendency to satisfy popular demands. They will confiscate wealth at the cost of production, and by the time the cycle is run, Everything will be run through a government system which cannot respond to any demands for sensible proprietary situations, sensible productive situations, respecting the laws of scarcity, understanding the need for competition. So I think, in effect, the restlessness of the Democratic Party is there. It's also expressed in another way, and I'll just end on this note, which is packing the Supreme Court. That's the kind of thing that people do in banana republics. If it turns out that you now are Democrats and you get the election, you say, well, we'd like to have a 6-5 Democratic majority. Let's do it. Then the Republicans, if they ever get back in power, make it 7-6 the other way. It turns out that under these circumstances, there is no independent check for the judiciary. A huge portion of our Constitution, including the operation of parts of the Electoral College, and of course the question of how we appoint Supreme Court nominees and the number that we choose, are sort of sub-constitutional texts of immense importance. And when you start going after that portion with a kind of a restless, angry attack, it's likely to end you in a very dangerous place indeed.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.